Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Pope Benedict makes a pastoral visit to Rome's Agostino Gemelli Hospital and talks about the relationship between faith and science. We hear from a doctoral student at the hospital's bioethics centre. And human life concerns at the heart of the Church's mission in the United States. Bishop Blaise Supich of Spokane calls for a frank and respectful dialogue within the Church and throughout American society. Benedict on Thursday visited Rome's Agostino Gemelli Teaching Hospital, located to the north of the city centre. Founded by Blessed Agostino Gemelli, it is renowned as the official hospital for the Pope, and a suite of reserved rooms is always available for him there. This year, the Gemelli is marking the 50th anniversary of the establishment of its medical faculty, the teaching hospital of the Catholic University of the Sacred Heart. In his address to the faculty and staff, the Pope spoke of the need to restore the wings of science and faith to research and healthcare. My colleague Emma McCarthy has the details.
Cari studenti, cari pazienti.
The mid-morning appointment outside a newly erected University Center for Life gave Pope Benedict the opportunity to return to one of the central themes of his seven-year pontificate, the unlikely couple of science and faith, and the deep bond between them. The Holy Father told the authorities, professors, healthcare professionals, and students gathered before him that theirs is no mere profession. Instead, they have a mission to help modern society move beyond the reductionist view of science and medicine, which excludes God and the transcendent, and which has generated a dangerous imbalance between what is technically possible and what is morally good, with risky and unpredictable consequences.
Scienza e fede hanno una reciprocità feconda.
Pope Benedict then developed his address around one, perhaps the most worrying, of these consequences, the loss of the meaning of things. This, he said, is the result of a progressive weakening of thought and ethical impoverishment. To reverse this trend, the Pope said, we must rediscover the wellspring that scientific research shares with the search for faith, upon which European culture and its values system were built, but now seems forgotten. Father Gemelli, he said, brought the human person in his fragility and greatness back to the centre of attention, no less aware of the limits and the mystery of life.
Senza amore, anche la scienza perde la sua nobiltà.
And, the Pope concluded, without love, even science loses its nobility. Only love guarantees the humanity to research.
Solo l'amore garantisce l'umanità della ricerca.
I'm Emma McCarthy.
The Gemelli Medical Faculty also houses the university's Bioethics Centre, which trains students in clinical bioethics, teaching them how to advise patients and doctors. Charles Collins spoke to Joseph Meany, a doctoral candidate in the bioethics programme, to find out more about what the centre does.
Well, essentially all the hospitals in Italy and in most countries in the world now have ethics committees. So when there's a serious case that comes up and the doctors really don't know what is licit to do or not, they will consult the ethic committee and see, you know, what procedures may be permissible, what needs to be done in certain situations when it's just not ethically clear.
Can you give us an example, a hypothetical case where such a clinical ethics problem would happen?
Sure. I mean, a person is dying of cancer and decides that he no longer wants treatment. And so then the doctors feel that he should continue the treatment, but the patient doesn't want that. And so then they all consult with the ethics committee to see whether the treatment is especially burdensome, if it's really an extraordinary means at this point, if the patient really needs to continue with this treatment or can forego it and just go for palliative care. That happens fairly frequently.
Now, in your work now that you're doing in the Gemelli, do you meet mostly with doctors? Do you meet with patients? What does a clinical ethicist do?
Yeah, there's a really wide range of personal contacts. So you definitely meet with the patients. Sometimes the patients are either mentally incompetent or even unconscious. At that point, you meet with those family members or those who have sort of a medical guardianship over that patient. You meet with the doctors. It's very important, actually, for a good bioethicist to know some of the science, you know, what the medical procedures are and what the implications are, but also to have a certain, you know, physical contact and counseling even with these persons who are grieving in a very serious situation.
What kind of interaction does an ethicist have with the patient? Do they just discuss the ethical concerns, or is it more personal than that?
Sure. A lot of it has to do, I mean, there's an informed consent aspect. So you have to communicate in very simple language, generally, what the situation is and what the different treatment options are. But beyond that, you have to realize that these persons are under huge stress. They're very sick generally. And so you have to have a pastoral component where you understand their feelings and help them to also prepare for death in many circumstances.
When you get to a situation where a patient has choices and all the choices are technically licit, what is the role of the ethicist in that situation?
Generally speaking, when you're in a gray area or you're in an area where there are multiple possible choices, the patient needs to really reflect well on what is best for them and what is best for their families. In many circumstances, patients don't want to be a burden on their families, and that sometimes skews their thinking. So they say, well, I just want to die right now so my family doesn't, you know, grieve or doesn't have to pay out or whatever it is. That usually we try to discourage. I mean, it should be a little bit more objective, and being a burden on one's family is not necessarily such a bad thing. In fact, family members generally take this opportunity to step up and show their love for their family member. So actually, at the end of life issues in particular, it's very important for them to realize that it's a joint process and, you know, not to feel isolated, that they're being a burden on everybody and they should just end their suffering and go away. Rather, it's a moment to grow and also to prepare for eternal life. So as a Catholic institution and in these Catholic hospitals, the pastoral component is very, very important.
We've talked about what your relationship is like with the patients. What is it like with the doctors?
With the doctors, it's interesting because frequently there's a certain sense where they want to avoid making a decision. And so there's a hard decision that needs to be made, and they don't want to take full responsibility for it, so they'll turn to the ethics committee. And unfortunately, in some countries, ethics committees have become sort of yes people, where they'll just say yes to whatever decision the doctor really wants to do but doesn't feel comfortable taking that decision, rather than actually studying the cases. And one of the things that's wonderful about the Catholic University of the Sacred Heart is that they say, look, we have to be faithful to the truth. We have to be faithful to what is right. We sometimes get into conflicts with doctors because of that. But still, we try to have as good of a relationship as we can with the medical personnel and to be of assistance to them. But we also try to avoid being yes persons who just say yes to whatever they really want to do, but they don't want to take responsibility and risk a lawsuit or whatever else.
How difficult is the work of an ethicist, for example, a Catholic ethicist such as you, when you get into the realm of non-Catholic hospitals? Are you using different starting points when talking about medical ethics in these cases?
Yeah, it is much more difficult in a non-Catholic context because there's so many more options on the table that are just not acceptable from an ethical point of view. So in many circumstances, doctors will be pushing abortion in cases of pregnant women who have medical complications, and the abortion they think would solve this problem. There are also situations where there's a push increasingly for, you know, unethical treatment at end of life that would either starve the patient or put them into a coma when that's not necessarily good. So we have much more challenges. And that at that point, really, the ethicist needs to make a personal connection with the patient because the patient's will is going to override what the doctors and the hospital wants to do. But it's more difficult because there's more of a conflictual relationship at times.
Do hospitals have a responsibility to try, for a non-religious hospital, Do they have a responsibility to try and find an ethicist who is of the same moral or religious background as the patient?
They don't, actually. So these hospitals will form their own ethics committees, and then they just choose who they want to be on those committees. So in a sense, Catholics are sometimes excluded even before getting to the stage of being on the ethics committee, because they know that some of the things they're going to want the ethics committee to approve are not morally acceptable to Catholics. So that is a problem. Now, patients themselves can call in an ethical consult from outside the hospital, and so we can do that at times. But it is a little bit of coming in from the outside and being a little bit more conflictual sometimes.
Charles Collins speaking there to Joseph Meany, a doctoral candidate in the bioethics program at Rome's Agostino Gemelli Teaching Hospital. Human life concerns are at the heart of the Church's mission in countries all around the world. They've also been the focus of discussions here in the Vatican by Church leaders from the United States who've been coming to Rome over these past 6 months for their ad limina visits. Among those visiting the different councils and congregations, as well as meeting with Pope Benedict at the end of April, was Bishop Blaise Supich of Spokane Diocese in the eastern part of Washington State. I sat down with him to talk about the challenges facing the Church in the U.S. today, in particular these human life concerns. You're here for your ad limina visits to the Vatican. One of the key areas, I believe, under discussion is this question of the Church in the U.S., its role within the public square, brought to a head, of course, over Obama's healthcare plan. How concerned are you that there is any serious threat to the Church's right to be a part of the national debate?
The issue that was provoked by the first decision of the Health and Human Services caused concern legitimately because it depended on a government definition of what a religious organization is. And there were four criteria. Other than being tax exempt already, being a 501c3, as we call it, organization, but also an organization that served primarily Catholics, employed mostly Catholics, and also had at its mission the conveyance of the teaching of the Church. Well, that's a very narrow definition of what religion, and as the American Magazine editorial said, what the government is doing by that decision is confining our exercise, free exercise of religion, to just the walls within a church building within a liturgical setting. And that was unacceptable to us. So that was my primary concern with the HHS decision.
Do you think this decision was taken at the beginning because of a lack of understanding of the Church and what it does, what it really is?
It's always good to ascribe the best motives to people, I find. So that is why I have encouraged dialogue so that that kind of understanding or misunderstanding can be corrected. And I think that if that is the case, then we need to make that very clear without ascribing motives to anyone. But it also seems that if there is an intransigence to see the point, which we believe is very legitimate, then we're going to have to be more aggressive in laying out the case for ourselves.
Others, as you know, see a campaign, an orchestrated campaign by secularists, by pro-choice lobbies. How much truth is there in that, do you think?
Well, I believe there are forces that would want to see this kind of shrinking of the role of practice of the faith in society. But at the same time, it's very important for people to understand that the mandate of the HHS really wasn't created ex nihilo, out of nothing. There has been an ongoing movement, mostly by the judiciary, not the executive branch, but also legislatures, that have demanded that particular services, which we find objectionable, be a part of not only healthcare plans, but also funded by government money. It is true, for instance, in the United States, that contraception has been funded for state workers, for federal workers, almost since World War II through what we call the FICA taxes, that is, the federal income tax that has the Social Security component to it. We also have seen various states through their Medicaid use state dollars that match federal dollars to provide abortion services. And in my own state of Washington, the tax that is on sales tax, funds abortion. So we really have seen this use of government money for these services that have been objectional prior to the HHS decision. So it's part of that bigger picture, I think, that people need to understand.
This pro-life question, the church's pro-life stance, really is at the heart of the current debate, isn't it, over the right to have a voice in the public square. Do you see it as one of the priorities, defending this position?
Yes, I do, but it's also important to understand that our position with regard to human dignity begins with the unborn but doesn't end there. That is something that we have tried to spell out very clearly in Faithful Citizenship, our document. By the way, it was just posted this week, but there is a terrific video in both Spanish and English that lays out all of the principles of Faithful Citizenship that I would encourage listeners to view. It's at the usccb.org website. And I think it does a wonderful job of having various voices speak to the broad range of issues.
There does seem to be a polarization, doesn't there, between those who would see it as just the abortion, euthanasia issue, and, as you're rightly saying, the much broader issues of defense of the poor, the care for the most vulnerable.
War and peace. All of the issues.
The death penalty.
And all of those are together. There's one fabric that it all fits together. And so I think that we have to make clear, because there are people, there are voices within our own community that would like to cherry pick the issues. There are some who want only war and peace and forget about the child in the womb. There are those who want to defend only the child in the womb but don't want to do anything with the death penalty. So what we're trying to do is to see that you really have to take the whole bowl of cherries, not just the ones that you want, because there is an organic nature to our teaching. And I think that as long as people in good conscience inform themselves of all of the issues, they can make then prudential judgments when it comes to voting.
How worried are you about what appears to be an increasing polarization over these issues? We've heard some very vitriolic language recently. You're calling for a very respectful debate. How possible is that in the current climate?
Well, I think that if there are challenges to the possibility, we have to put them aside and address them. I think we have to take this up. We have no alternative. We have to be articulate in what we're saying. We have to do it in a respectful way. Fulton J. Sheehan, the great preacher, Catholic bishop in the United States, once said that if all you're interested is winning an argument, you'll never win a convert. But aside from the fact that we want our voice to penetrate into society in a civil way, there's another aspect to this that I think we as leaders need to keep in mind, and that is the young people. Today, from various studies that have been done on the mindset of young people with regard to religion, they are going to turn off harsh voices. And if, in fact, they are not given a means by which they can articulate their faith and understand it, then they're only going to have a choice between being nice and nasty. And if that's the only choice we give them without an articulated understanding of their faith, they're going to always choose the nice, even if there is no articulation of the faith. So we have to be careful about what we're doing in approaching our young people. They're listening to us, and we have to pay attention to how we're having an impact on them.
The internet, social networks, they have a lot to answer for in terms of amplifying this nice, nasty debate, don't they? Are you concerned about that?
Well, there is, because there's a profit motive in being nasty, and that sells. That sells very easily. That's why we have to stand above the fray and not participate in it. And we have to be confident of our position to the point that we can say what we believe in a very articulated way. Charles Taylor once wrote that the more articulate you are, the better you're going to be able to describe reality. And I think that is something that's hard work. Teaching is hard work. You talk to anybody who's been in a classroom, a student who doesn't get it on the first bounce, you have to be more determined, more creative in order to get your point across. My concern is that leaders sometimes shy away from the real hard work of teaching with discipline, with patience, and they would rather just put the message out there sometimes and then say, well, it's up to you to get it, and if you don't, then then it's your fault. We don't have, I don't think, that luxury as teachers in the church. And we have to be patient with people, come back at it, and maybe learn from the experience of refashioning the message, realizing that perhaps the way we're couching the issue, way we're framing it, is inadequate, and we need to be able to be more creative in getting the message across.
I'd like to look at the latest development regarding the U.S. Church, the Vatican's announcement of the need to reform some of the female religious institutes and organizations. Again, a development that seems on the surface to be widening divisions between bishops and sisters. How much hope do you have for a really respectful dialogue on this?
There really are two aspects to all of this. The first was the visitation of the religious communities that took place. And although there were voices that expressed certain fear, maybe in an exaggerated way, it has proven to be very helpful. I think the report that will come out soon, and we were at the Congregation for Religious, it will be an opportunity for all of us to grow, for religious communities. And I understand from some of the dialogue that we have had within our bishops' conference that while there were some fears, they really have been addressed in the way that it has been conducted. And so I think that's one issue. But the other issue now that's more current is the work that Archbishop Sartin from our province, the Archbishop of Seattle, has been given along with Bishop Papraki and Bishop Blair, Leonard Blair of Toledo, to work with the Leadership Conference of Religious Women, it's the LCWR, it's called, to address certain concerns that the Holy See has, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. And so though that dialogue has been given a framework of 5 years to address, so it's not as though anyone's coming in and clamping down, that there is a decision made without dialogue and respectful cooperation, but they're saying these are aspects that have to be addressed here. And so since we don't know too much about the origins of this, how this is going to play out, and it is in the hands of Archbishop Sartin, who is a man of wonderful ability and respected highly by people from across the board. And my hope would be that this, too, can be an opportunity for growth for not only the Leadership Conference of Religious Women, but also the church, church at large. So I would just ask people to cool down, to take a step back and see how this plays out. But to be frank, to address the questions and the issues that are legitimate, that the Holy See needs to raise.
Have you had conversations with sisters in your own Diocese of Spokane over this?
I received some emails. People want to know what were the origins of this, how did this get started. They want to know why the Congregation of the Doctrine of Faith as opposed to the Congregation of Religious. And I think those questions are legitimate and need to be answered. It does show that some of the major concerns are doctrinal in nature rather than having to do with religious life per se. And so as a result, I think the Congregation for Religious obviously is going to have to be involved at some point simply because they have the competence to deal with statutes. And if statutes are going to be reformed and addressed, then at some point they are going to have to be brought in, because that is my understanding, at least, one of their areas of competence.
We're marking this year the anniversary of the Second Vatican Council, and yet the vision of the sisters compared with the vision perhaps here from Rome, the vision of the hierarchy, seems to be rooted in the understanding of what that council really called for. Do you agree with that assessment, first of all?
Well, I do. I think that the council is a point of reference that people use many times to put forward their position. And I know the Holy Father has been concerned about the need to make sure that we take all of the documents, not just, again, cherry pick, as a phrase has been used, or to have a kind of cafeteria-style approach to the documents of the Second Vatican Council. One has to look at the full panorama of all of that. And a document that's very important, Lumen Gentium, about the nature of the Church, I think deserves particular attention. The first document of the Council was the Sacrosanctum Concilium on the liturgy, and that seems to, in some way, have set the standard by which people are going to judge all the other documents. But you really do have to look at all of them together. My hope would be that this tension that you're mentioning here is an opportunity for all of us to grow, to go back and see where the differences are, but to mine the resources of the documents in a way that's going to promote the kind of charity in the discussion that we should be having in the first place.
It's a tension really over renewal, reform, a vision of the church in the 21st century, a modern church, a thoroughly modern church, and this resourcement or returning to the roots of the early church, isn't it?
Yes, that's true. I believe, however, that the renewal that is going to take place has to be rooted in the origins of the church, in the nature of the church as it's expressed, particularly in patristic documents. That really was the fundamental impetus that reformed the liturgy the way we had. The liturgy that we've had in terms of the liturgical reform has come about not just in going back in a very anachronistic way and replicating how the church in the early centuries worshipped. There are some elements that are important, but to say that there were some things that were missed simply because we had accumulated so many other either symbolic structures or aspects maybe of the culture of the empire of the Middle Ages that was part of that era, and put them into the liturgy that in some way cloaked the beauty of the noble and distinct quality of the Latin Rite. And I think that that's what the Council did. It tried to have the noble simplicity of the Church's Rite that spoke with its clarity and the way that the symbols were so very clear that communicated the reality that was there. And so I think that resourcement is very important to the renewal. And there are ways in which those two can be linked.
Finally, what message are you taking back to your diocese of Spokane? What has been most encouraging for you, perhaps, here during your ad limina visit?
I think that it comes down to, in visiting with the various dicasteries, the various offices here, by and large, the approach has been, we want to hear from you. We want to listen. We want to learn from you. We have some issues that we want to talk to you about that are important, but we also want to learn from you. We heard that in many instances of our visits with the various congregation dicasteries. And that is really very encouraging because it shows that there is a mindset in the vast majority of the offices here at the Vatican that sees that the lived experiences of our churches is a value that they need to hear about, and it will inform their decisions. So that is something that gives me encouragement as I go back, that we are really making a contribution to the life of the Universal Church as we also hear the concerns of the Universal Church that can impact our own life in our particular church that we go back to. So that is something that I take back with me and feel very encouraged about.
Thanks there to Bishop Blaise Supich of Spokane Diocese in the eastern part of Washington State in Rome for his ad limina visit at the end of April. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.